FM.com/map.
You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, coming to you with William English speaking to Ed Baxter from the Science Gallery about the science film Dirt by Pierre Helitzer. We're having a few technical difficulties, so
Ed, can you explain your particular interest in Bobby Driscoll before we maybe...
Do you know, William, I wish I could, actually. I have to go back to maybe 20, 25 years ago. I was quite sick for a week, and I was bedbound. This is as an adult, not kind of feeble child, like food poisoning or something. Yeah. And all I did was watch black and white movies on the television, put at the end of my bed. It was the kind of thing I very rarely do or did. Mm-hmm. I remember one afternoon there was the extraordinary Captain January starring Shirley Temple that was so bizarre I actually had to turn it off. I found it distressing, actually psychologically distressing. I thought, well, that's interesting. And about 2 days later, still sick, a film starring Eddie Cantor called If You Knew Susie came on.
Right.
Also, one of these utterly bizarre American films in which Eddie Cantor, the great crooner of the 30s and 40s, he was playing a character slightly like himself who was retiring from vaudeville. And so the film, as I remember it, opens with Eddie Cantor blacked up as a minstrel.
Oh, really?
Doing his farewell performance. Mm-hmm. And then in a domestic scene of kind of very arch, cute comedy with Eddie Cantor's eye rolling, this boy lay on a bed waving his legs in the air. Oh. So like you saw the back of his legs flicking, and this was Bobby Driscoll. And again, I thought, this is a really weird period in American history, and I
in American film history, or
no, just in American culture. And I think it's something to do with
the 40s. That
would have been
the film
post,
was made?
Post Second World War,
Okay.
That film, yeah. And looking back, as some of these films do, to an earlier historical period, but not much earlier, and all these things kind of I think very slowly, and now and of course at the same time, I suppose I was reading, as one does, Hollywood Babylon,
okay.
Kenneth Anger's book, and so I recognised that the child actor in If You Knew Susie was this character who Anger, in kind of typically waspish fashion, paints as a...
But Driscoll was also in the other one, Captain January. Then.
No, that was much earlier. That was just a kind of coda, if you like. I suppose it's about the invention of childhood in the era of mass entertainment, and it's something that happens very rapidly, because I don't think people thought much about childhood until the middle of the 19th century, and then it becomes an accelerated point of interest, to the point where by the late 50s you have people like Raymond Scott making soothing sounds for baby, so like homemade synthesizer music that is designed for infants as infant consumers. And parallel to that, you have people like Bobby Driscoll personifying a certain part of the atomic age as it is refracted through Walt Disney's supra-nationalist celebration of a very bullish America, and it's the dissolution of that bullishness in the 60s that I suppose is intriguing. And the I think in the Kenneth Anger book, he doesn't mention Bobby Driscoll's dalliance with the New York avant-garde scene, and it was discovering that fact very recently, so I hadn't been thinking about Bobby Driscoll for 20 years, honestly. Right. Made me think, well, there was the narrative became a lot more satisfying and interesting, so that he wasn't just another burnt-out child actor. He was somebody who the dissolution of that half dreamt image.
This is all this image of where he's got his legs kicking in the air.
No, that's nothing to do with that. That's just one of those epiphanies. No, you think of his part in Peter Pan and in Song of the South, where there's animation and live action kind of spliced together in a way that renders the living people animations rather than the animations live.
And is this sort of markedly different from, say, Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney and so on?
Yeah, there's no avant-garde art scene at the end of the biopic, is there?
So that counts for you then, the fact that he got...
I think that makes it intriguing you think there might have been some second chapter to contradict F. Scott Fitzgerald's assertion that there are no second chapters in American life, or words to that effect, isn't it? Or no second acts in American life, says F. Scott Fitzgerald.
I'm turning to our small audience here. We do have an audience here.
We have an audience. We had a helicopter overhead. Yeah. That was the rattling sound.
We've got William Fowler here from the British Film Institute and DJ Hybridist, who I turned to Sandra because she happens to know a bit about F. Scott Fitzgerald. She might have known that quote. And William might even remember the Eddie Cantor film.
This is all tiny, obscure fragments that reveal how the workings of my mind are. So I kind of store these numinous thoughts away and hope that one day they will prove not to be wasted, although some of them are wasted in some way.
Right.
But I was intrigued by the existence of dirt and...
Yes, I mean, you basically asked me. I mean, we started with this because I wanted to try and find a DVD copy. It's unavailable on DVD. The New York Film Co-op have a 5-minute version, which they are reluctant to hire out to anything except institutions. So I sort of gave up with that one. So this version we're going to show is from the Lux in London. This is a 15-minute version. It seems it was originally shot on standard 8mm by Piero Helixer, and the original version apparently lasts 40 minutes, although I then read an obituary which was published in the Independent, which my researcher found for me, and that suggests that in fact Dirt exists as a 3-hour version. So I've no idea where these films are to be had. They might still exist as standard 8mm films in the estate of Piero Helixer. I think his widow or ex-partner lives in Amsterdam now.
Well, like a lot of these threads that one picks up, you wonder where it might lead. Yeah. So being sick and seeing If You Knew Susie might lead to a Helixer retrospective and a discovery of...
A rediscovery of the 3-hour version of Dirt, which must be around somewhere.
Yeah, so we're dealing with...
Which might include more footage of Bobby Driscoll, for all
I think, again, going back to this idea of the manifestations of the atomic age, the fragmentation of bodies of work and the atomization of the human body in mass-mediated film and television. I think these are the bubbling under themes that we tried to process through our grasp of recording technologies. Mm. Yeah. So to my mind, there's a sort of almost clear narrative trajectory, but I'm more interested in the wallowing in meaningless detail and the staring into space that watching movies entails.
Should we run Dirt?
Yeah, please. Now we have our audience has swelled.
It has swelled by 100% to include...
Is there a Zoom lens in the house?
We don't need it, thank you, Mr. Lester. We have David Lester, projectionist, here. But I'm going to quickly... Ed, by all means, carry on talking. I'll just run.
We're having a few technical difficulties, so I'm going to play you the fifth sketch for Ascent and Descent, part of a series performed by the Resonance Radio Orchestra, which includes themes about Bobby Driscoll. This was performed and recorded live in Kilfinan at the Hearsay Festival, performed by Sarah Nicol, Ed Baxter, Peter Lansley, and Willie Carr. So this is fifth sketch for Ascent and Descent.
The cause of it is gravity. Isaac Newton knew nothing of life in the desert, even less of nomadic customs. So how could he be expected to understand the angels, especially in an era before the Royal Mail had brought his homeland into something resembling a coherent whole? But gravity, there the old boy was surely on the button. He sat in the orchard that day, thinking of Willem Tell and how he'd thrown apples at his son all evening in the orchard, at his no-good son, and of Little John, the man of stone, log-rolling with Robin Hood in the vast wildernesses of Appalachia, wrestling him like a gorilla. A real Monroe he was, iron to the core, and Newton taught of the garden, and he bent down to pick up some fruit, and a trap nearly left us with nothing but the stuff on the angels. Now Adam Clark thought it was the form of an ape, not a serpent, that Satan assumed in the Garden of Eden. And Charles Fort thought, with a touch of the H.P. Lovecrafts, that fossil records showed apes to be descended from men. Newton picking up a pen. Willem Tell in an orchard, throwing apples at his no-good son. The image of Little John's grave on the rubber, on sale in the church in High Peak. I'll come back to these if I'm given enough time. And the toast. Will you ever forget the toast as long as you live? The toast. But you asked for a story, and the story is around here that some while ago a nun disappeared from a nearby convent, never to be seen again, except by strangers, late at night, or at least at dusk, when her black habit could be distinguished from the impenetrable night that rolls in from the valley below. Some spiritual malaise had gripped the poor woman, and so she threw herself down a well. Others said she was drowned like a cat by a spurned secret lover, or heard to sigh by the ever-vigilant Almighty as she stood by an empty country road, thinking of all the time that had passed, and of the trees, and of the inexorable rolling of the earth. She was struck by lightning, and this perfunctory judgment of God extinguished her entirely, leaving nothing but a tiny pile of ashes you could have fit inside a matchbox had you taken out your Chinese baby first. Whatever the facts that inform the front end of the story, the freight of humour and misty myth in the rear carries her tale into folklore. And sure enough, her shadow was seen on many a moonlit night, her heavy steps heard in graveyards, and even on pub staircases where no nun had a right to be treading. And the rhythm of her rosary fell like the sigh of death himself as he ranged across the country on nights when black clouds enveloped the hills and black stallions ran riot, and the dogs, large and small alike, curled up and whimpered at the booming wind that raged then at the window. And the radio sputtered and stammered and seemed to be waiting on the terrible payload of death notices that the empty hours before morning promised to the still dreaming town. All this happened in the past, you understand, at a time when all cohered. The world was but an apple sitting on the head of God, and no one, not even Loki, far less Little John, was aiming to knock it off his noggin. All of it happened in the past. Backed in too, there was a boy who could blow a whistle while he was standing on his head. Name of Bob, or Robert, but never Rob, or Bobby. Not from round here. No, this Bobby was a creature of light, not exactly emerging from outer space, but at least from the other side of the infinite Atlantic, and some distance away from the darkness that hung then hereabouts. New encounters with such a creature were even rarer than encounters with the ghostly nun. But on nights when the low-flying mist stood still at the base of the mountains, silently standing like an invading army that awaits the dawn, and on days when it wasn't really raining, just a passing drop or two, not enough to distract you from the sunlight. On days when you could feel the nutrients passing through you and passing into the next fella and ricocheting off the walls of the picture house. On such days his face would appear, and sometimes you'd even see the whole of him, not just his face, as he flew overhead, flew unaware of gravity. Apes, angels, apples, armies, iron, landlords, logs, babies, clouds, giants, hillsides, of the immortal Percy French, of the crow in the field, and of the inexorable rolling of the earth in the still, shapeless universe. All this happened in the past. In the past. 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 The past, 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 the past. Well, as to the past, as I think I probably said or implied at least, what seems formless now had form. What seems incoherent and even pointless to us all unfolded in with the force of necessity. What appears rotten and flabby and stinks of sour decay was green and young and firm as Peter Pan's windpipe. But all this was resolved for a moment that morning when we stood by Little John's grave. I put a coin into the parking meter left there in the graveyard for donations. We walked into the church, a still and solemn church with a tidy graveyard, entered through a wide wooden gate after a steep climb. Steep if you're pushing a pram. Inside they were selling souvenirs. I bought a bright pink rubber, there were no pencils, on which was printed an image of the grave of Little John, a soft thing, soon worn away, to embody the enduring monument which marked the mythical incarnation of the stone man, the timeless giant who arose from the mountain. But you've come expecting narrative rather than digression, so narrative you must have. It was one of those nights that I mentioned earlier. Dark it was, and the rain had been falling for so long that the background hum of it ceased to be all noticed. So all felt silent as the grave of a blameless infant or a resting giant. The moon's bare bum shone through the massy clouds like the flesh of your lover on a fresh pillow it was. And the numberless stars were scattered like ants fleeing a flooded flour mill. And I was there, me myself, I, as if in a dream or a low-budget film. So seamlessly strange was the uncanny time, so full of space the streets, so vast the canopy of the night sky, so distant the length of time from the here and now. And there, as I huddled in the wind and hid my face from the rain, as I hurried on my way home, a dark figure, dressed all in black, as if enrobed in the habits of the newly deceased, appeared from an alley or a doorway and darted down the shining street. Startled, I followed in pursuit, up Main Street, right into Lock Street, across the Mill Road, Mill Hill, crossing and along Traden Area, right again, back towards Mill Hill, left and left again into Shrodnafaha. I chased her along the R517, past Mr. Kebab, past Old Doherty's house, down past the Ballyhoura development, Murphy service station on the right, and Michael Hayes' interiors on the left. Then finding myself at the edge of the village where Modern's Cross appears, just as the road enters something resembling a fairly straight run, at length I gained some ground. And now at last I caught up with the fugitive figure, which seemed, under the moon, now full as a bucket of miscalf milk, to pause for an instant as if on a half-perceived precipice, trembling, breathless, panting in my sudden triumph. I grabbed her by the black shoulders, spun her round, ready to shake her, to kick her shiny nun shins, even to slap her sappy soft face. But Jimmy Cricket, if it wasn't Bobby himself, a bit older now, not much, but still his skin was creased with laughter lines, or the lines left by a long-term grimace, like a sailor whose face is fixed by a wayward boom in a fatal storm. Bobby, dressed in black habit, pouting defiantly, for a second a smouldering vamp. The next moment he fells me with a headbutt, but, and my being in slow motion explodes in a million tiny dwindling lights, and the universe unrolls like the rug containing Cleopatra herself, and the darkness of MacDonald descends on the end of this act. But there's no applause, because the narrative is so obviously only halfway done. Obviously. And how the old noise swells, and how it rages inside my sore head. Fade to a deeper black, wakes to gibberish, a confusion of lemons, incoherence is their want. I, for one, welcome the machine overlords and look forward to them making me money. Aloof, I alone was known in the land of lost limbs, served on a silver platter. Like John, I was tossed in the trash.
an iron-bound door. Lay him out on a iron-bound supper and sing if he wanted to take a break or go to the bathroom. And the bathroom itself was nothing to write home about. Even if you had somehow learned to write more than the cross that was demanded by the person in charge, who at that time was less a man than a kind of ogre, a big ugly fellow he was, who sat in his chair and sucked the blood from the people and ate the very marrow of the land to satisfy his bottomless appetite, and lifted a buttock now and then to express his fleeting satisfaction. The lad doesn't take to this situation, and soon there's ill feeling hereabouts and over all the county, which sooner still takes a turn for the worst, and dark days ensue, with much grinding of teeth on either side, and only the crows are truly happy. And the town grows restless and divided, and there's nothing, it seems, will bring peace back to the mountain. Things come to a head one Friday morning, accused of heinous crimes, which, even if he is guilty, merits universal praise instead of punishment. The young man is tried and judged and torn apart, and the bits of his body are buried in different parts of the world. His head they sent to the North Pole, where it is buried on the ice, in the icy waste, where even the starving polar bears can't find it. The left foot ends up in Shackleton's hut in Antarctica, the right in a sunken ship off Tuvalu, out there in the warm Pacific. One leg is buried in Bolivia, the other in North Korea, and several joints of his fingers, there were 29, he lost one in an accident, are buried in lots of places you've never been to, like Milan or Kiev or Hartlepool, say. His private parts are cast into an abandoned tin mine along the coast from Port Leven. His torso ends up in the Azores. His heart is carried away by a fair maiden, and she digs a hole in a field not far from here to house it. The executioners, the killers meantime, there are five of them, each meet with a terrible aerial fate. A plunges to her death from a hot air balloon into the sulphurous maw of Mount Etna. The terrible effects of fatally poisonous gas are mitigated only by the action of molten lava on the hopelessly fragile human organism. Four left. B sucked into the whirring propellers of an enormous cargo plane, which taxiing along the runway in a remote part of Papua New Guinea, swerves suddenly, and as if by magic, the sad sack of wet organs is reduced in the blink of an eye to a series of mere bloody puddles, which soon dry up in the summer sun. Three to go. C takes a trip on a rocket to a distant planet. He is one of the fabulously wealthy tourists whose appetite for adventure knows no bounds. The airlock malfunctions and he is catapulted in his shiny white spacesuit into infinite blackness, freezing to death after agonizing minutes in which his removal from everything human turns his brain to mush. After a final, all too brief epiphany of his smallness, his meanness, his complete and utter insignificance in the grand scheme of things, as well as in his tardy private life, nearly done now, D is hit in the eye by a child's kite, his daughter's, as they play on the beach on a torpid seaside resort. The dowel rod penetrates his brain and he dies, writhing in exquisite agony and howling like a speared hog. The traces of his anguish in the sand forming wondrous abstract patterns reminiscent of the best examples of late 20th century performance art. Four down. And E, the last of what you will agree is a bad lot, is pursued by a rogue wing of an apparently supine government agency to join a fanatical terrorist cell whose evangelical mission is to be advanced by the destruction of a universally recognizable public monument using a hijacked passenger jet. On the eve of the selected doomsday, E is chosen by a lot to pilot the plane. The last we see of him, his eyes are wide open in a silent scream as the airliner, packed with hapless, hysterical tourists, ploughs straight into the grand pyramid of Sheepers in the Valley of the Kings, utterly engulfed in titanic phosphorescence flames that can be seen from outer space. That's the lot. Where the boy's body parts are buried, from each little grave beams a light, shoots up into the sky, lighting up the earth and looking like nothing so much as a gigantic pincushion by the cosmos. By a process of elimination, sorting these beams from the numerous stars and ignoring all those numberless neutrons, we can put the pieces back together and from the distance make an approximation as to what he looked like. This lost lad, and on days when the sun streams through the blinds, if you look out over the valley amidst the fall out of the atomic era and in the cracks between clouds and in those tears in the space-time continuum, you hear so much about these. You hear so much about these days. On such days, you can catch a glimpse of his once faded features. on the landing stands outside my neighbor's door. Sarah, Sarah, it's Anthony. You understand, it all happened in the past. Sarah, it's Anthony. He bites hard on his fist, places his fist against his forehead. He ruminates. He leans towards the silent door. Into the silent door, he says, Sarah, 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 it's me, Anthony. The light in the stairwell stays on a minute or two more. You close your door. You see him unseen underneath you. His head presses against the door in the dark, saying, Sarah, Sarah, please, it's Anthony.
We're still on Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. Here in the studio with Ed Baxter and an audience of David Lester, William Fowler, Sandra Cross and Tom Gray. We have just been watching Dirt by Piero Helixa, which featured Bobby Driscoll dressed as a nun. What we've been listening to was a piece that you composed, a special radio piece.
And it was performed and recorded in Kilfinan in Ireland at the Hearsay Festival last weekend with a local storyteller, Willie Carr, reading a script that I'd written, in which the narrator pursues a ghostly nun figure across Kilfinan.
Right.
And in a pastiche of Don't Look Now, turns the nun around only to find out that the nun has the face of Bobby Driscoll. It's my idea of a joke, William.
Yes. Can you explain a bit more about the fascination with Bobby Driscoll? Yeah. For me, I just see the parallel with Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney and other child stars, particularly Judy Garland. Sandra, you might be able to help me out with this a bit about, well, the background of Judy Garland, because you know more about it than I do. I mean, she had she was encouraged, wasn't she, to take drugs and to keep her weight down and to look like a child and so on. It's quite a tragic story, isn't it? William might know about this too.
Well, I think she and who was the
Mickey
person?
Rooney.
Mickey Rooney, yes. They were obviously child stars. And when she played Dorothy in Over the Rainbow, she had to have her breasts sort of bound or something because she was older than she was supposed to be. I'm not sure how old she was supposed to be then, maybe 12 or something. But she might have been 14 or 15.
Yeah. But she eventually developed a habit for drugs and alcohol.
But like so many of these backstories, you know, she had an awful mother, pushy mother. You know, yeah. I'm not sure. I think maybe Ed should really talk about his fascination with Bobby Driscoll, really. I
mean, that's because we've already established that Ed's fascination with Bobby Driscoll has nothing to do with my interest.
It's a bit more abstract.
I'm not interested in these faux tragedies.
No, but they're not faux. They're real. It was absolutely real, wasn't it?
Well, you see, I view these people as extremely abstract.
You were saying earlier about how we perceive these people on screen and their kind of, I don't know what you call them, the residue that they have in the films. These are my words, not yours. I'm paraphrasing. But I find it interesting that in relationship to their real lives, like how do those two things come together?
Yes, okay.
Or real and in inverted commas.
I'd agree with that.
I mean, that's what that interests
me. I think maybe the thing to try and do is to bring those things into some sort of equilibrium and resolution rather than view them as opposed somehow. But isn't it the dissolution of
Bobby Driscoll that is actually the interesting thing? Because if he'd just been a child star and then became like sort of Ronald Reagan or something, you wouldn't be interested, surely. Why him specifically?
He's just completely archetypal. It's nothing to do with him specifically. It could almost have been any one of these characters who just exist in this energized field of movies and
but that's all actors, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
These are all actors, basically. You're saying you have the set.
I'm actually not interested in the actors. I'm interested in the energy in this frame that we view and the kind of cultural moment that these individuals seem to articulate.
But you did fix on Bobby Driscoll, which is why I hired the film.
Yeah, okay.
That's why we viewed Dirt and Bobby Driscoll dressed as a nun.
That's why you're here, man.
Yeah.
Own it.
So, I mean, if it had been Robert Mitchum or something.
Yeah, no, to find out if the narrative has any shape to it. It has an arc, yeah. It's like a...
The narrative
described by Kenneth Anger, which is the tragic actor dies of a drug overdose or whatever, is incomplete because it's actually... Actor dies of a drug overdose after being involved in the avant-garde movie world, which is light years away. It's like the other end of the continuum from a Walt Disney production. So it's a way of the thing that's interesting is the way his career encompasses and describes the entire. Sphere, the globe of mass communications in the 20th century. So I think that's why he is a.
But surely that's only because he destroyed himself. I mean, otherwise you could apply this to any other actor or actress in any film. I mean, it's only because of his self-destruct and descent into destitution that singles him out in a way.
No, because that's a classic American trope, isn't it? The self-destructive individual.
He does sort of stand out as a.
Well, no, because Hollywood Babylon, Kenneth Anger's book is like full of such people, isn't it? Like,
right.
There's about 300 of them or something.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's more the variations on the theme maybe that are interesting and the.
But that's about the movie industry sort of chewing people up in a way, isn't it? It's about people getting involved in the glitz and glamour, and it's the underbelly of that sort of the nightmare side of Hollywood.
Has it got something to do with that? You know, it almost sounds like what you're interested in is almost the holes, like the story that isn't told. So in between the Walt Disney and then the sort of tragic ending, and that almost it's the fragments of something that at some point you were on the receiving end of at different points, and that becomes
it's like a kind of puzzle.
And he himself is, I mean, I didn't really know who he was before hearing about today's session, and he himself has become a fragment in history as well. So it's sort of like layers of fragments, which become sort of quite tantalizing.
Yeah, it's the atomization of people's identities, isn't it? That's the interesting thing. And this seems to be the material of film and TV Exactly.
And we watched a fragment today of this film that they were.
And we're obsessed
by. We weren't sure if we were going to watch it because of its state, you know, its condition and so on.
We're obsessed by these coherent narratives, and I think this coherent narrative that I'm trying to construct is actually one of the destruction of its own coherence. If that doesn't sound extremely, it sounds like an avant-garde move.
Exactly.
It sounds like an Oulipo way of thinking.
Hmm.
Yeah. But I'm not. I can't. Having seen the film, I can't yet tell you what I really think. You
know? No, fair enough.
Right. You have to wait a few years.
Yeah.
And ask me again.
Yeah.
But I do thank you for hiring it.
No, that's fine. I was happy to see it myself. I was quite greatly relieved that it got through the projector without falling apart. And it's worth mentioning, I mean, after Helixer, Piero Helixer himself founded the Dead Language Press, which I was talking to William about, and he published Jack Smith's book, The Beautiful Book, and collaborated with Jeff Keane. And that's the Beautiful Book is considered to be one of the greatest American post-war photo books. And Helixer himself appears in Couch, Warhol's Couch. Any thoughts about the central section of Dirt?
No.
Okay.
It's
fair enough.
A classic 60s.
See, I thought, knowing scene. That you've written a book called Filth, I thought there was going to be some connection between like Dirt and Filth. There was something drawing you towards this particular.
No, that was a long time ago. I'd forgotten that.
Right.
I didn't even know you knew that.
Yeah, I've got a copy. You gave me a copy.
All right. Oh, it must have been a rare moment of fantasy.
So that's a complete red herring.
Yeah. Okay. No, complete red herring. Mm. Yeah.
So why do you ask about that section in the film?
Well, because it took up at least 10 minutes.
Yes.
And
I mean, I must say, as the only female member of the audience, I did find it somewhat awkward because I didn't know where it was going.
Right. No. But that's kind of it is typical kind of underground material from that time and so on.
Yes.
I found it awkward too for exactly the same reason because and then you think, oh, it's typical underground film, and then it means you can't really have any opinion about two naked women wrestling in a cheap iron bar in Manhattan.
Superimposed.
Which
made it four, actually.
Yeah. Kind of mirrors.
Four.
Yeah. Yes, the whole thing is very peculiar, really, wasn't it? When you
I was
try and analyse the content.
This is very innocent, given I
didn't mind.
That's what I was saying to myself whilst watching it and wondering where we were going.
Yeah.
In fact, we didn't go anywhere. We just went round in a circle, really, didn't we? You know, with splashing and there was hardly any touching. Really, it was just,
I mean, it was what it was. I didn't really have a problem with it. I quite like the way it was framed by the nun sequences in blue.
Yes.
I mean, it's very blue. And then the scene at the end, I suppose it was Kodachrome, David, presumably, if it was shot on standard 8 originally.
That would have been my guess.
Yeah, because we had this, it's very vivid blue, and this New York in the waterfront in the background. And then just for a fleeting moment, you see like a pink or red dress comes in to one side of the two nuns, which is, it's quite a beautiful scene, actually, I think. I
know, I wondered how you'd capture those images just by shooting, even with Kodachrome, just by shooting, to have such a dominant colour and then a kind of very different contrasting colour in the space. Without doing some kind of treating. I mean, David would know more than myself, but that seemed quite unusual to me.
Well, I remember someone described to me once what happens if you, in fact, I did it once by accident, where you go from Kodachrome to Kodachrome and you get an enrichment of the colours, particularly the reds and blues, and there's a name for that sort of, that process.
Well, it as if that was probably blown up from, was it Standard 8?
Standard 8, yeah.
So it would also depend what the intermediate stock was that you're blowing up on again.
Okay.
So whatever was in the, let's say, it was the optical printer, that could enhance the color of what was originally there and exaggerate it. Because every time you reprint something, it gets a slightly higher contrast, and you can actually then grade the colors up to be slightly more exaggerated.
Because there's a quote here, Helix's Dirt is one of the four works that uses 8mm film properly and for art's sake. That was from Movie Journal by Jonas Mekas. He seems to have been somewhat of a great proponent of standard eight movie making, which was probably pretty much against the grain.
No pun.
Yeah. When out of interest, have you ever read anything written by Janus that isn't very positive and enthusiastic?
No, but that was his big thing.
Yeah, of course. He was championing and starting something.
Yeah, the Pope of underground film, wasn't he? Okay, well, you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with special guest Ed Baxter, a screening of the silent film Dirt by Piero Helixa, and contributions by William Fowler, Sandra Cross, David Lester, and the silent Tom Gray.
But I've been enjoying listening.
Good. Okay, I'm out of here.